Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Fortune 500 CEO Douglas Conant and writer Amy Fetterman discuss their co-authored book, The Blueprint, Six Practical Steps to Lift Your Leadership to New Heights. They are interviewed by John Esty, immediate past chair of the Board of Trustees of the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place April 7th, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hi, everybody. My name is Gary Cranston. I want to welcome everyone here to this online program of the American Writers Museum. And we want to say we're grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. We have two very special guests today, the co-authors of the book, The Blueprint, Douglas R. Conant and Amy Fetterman. Doug Conant is an internationally renowned business leader, New York Times bestselling author, keynote speaker, and social media influencer with more than 40 years of leadership experience at world-class global companies. Doug has served in C-suite roles as president of Nabisco Foods, CEO of Campbell Soup, and as chairman of Avon Products. In 2011, he founded Conant Leadership, a mission-driven community of leaders and learners who are championing leadership that works in the 21st century. Amy Fetterman is a highly experienced writer, fastidious editor, passionate marketer, and voracious reader, and a social media infatuate. She has worked with Doug and the Conant Leadership Academy for nearly 8 years and has a long career in communications, writing, and digital marketing. And finally, our moderator today is another CEO with a long history of leadership. John Esty is currently chairman of SNC Electric, headquartered in Chicago. John has held a number of responsible positions at SNC Electric since 1972, including president and CEO. He's also served in leadership positions in the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers and the National Electrical Manufacturers Association. From a nonprofit perspective, John is a past member and chairman of the Adler Planetarium here in Chicago and is a director of the Shelter for Abused Women and Children in Naples, Florida. And most importantly for us, he is our current chair and a strong supporter of the American Writers Museum. At this point, I'm going to hand the program over to John and Doug and Amy.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you all who have joined us today. And one of the reasons we have such a large audience today are the stars of our show. Doug, it is a real privilege to have someone as accomplished and knowledgeable as you with us today. So thanks so much for being with us. And Amy, we are thrilled to have such a skilled author with us, and we're very much looking forward to learning from you about how people collaborate in creating a book like The Blueprint. Now, I know some have read the book and some have not yet read the book, so I'd like to start, Doug, with a bit of a level setter so people can get to know you a little better. As Carrie said, you've had an incredibly successful career, but maybe you could talk about, you know, something that happened early in your career when you got really unexpected bad news, and how that was so formative, and how that sort of helped in the crafting of the Blueprint book.
Sure, John, and thank you for having us. And speaking of Amy Fetterman, I know we'll get to her, but I learn from her every day. She's an extraordinary contributor to this process, and I'm thrilled that she can be part of the program. You know, it's funny. I was working in Boston, on the North Shore of Boston. I went into work one day after I had, my wife and I had moved there. We had just had our second son. We were living in Old Town Marblehead, living right on the seashore, the birthplace of the American Navy. My family had been the founding family of Salem, Massachusetts, right next door. It was all meant to be. And then I went into work one day at Parker Brothers Toys and Games, where I was director of marketing, and the receptionist sent me upstairs to talk to the senior vice president. And I had been working for this company and its parent company for almost 10 years. And the senior vice president said to me, "Doug, your job has been eliminated. You need to be out of here by noon. I wish you luck." And then I had to leave. My career was over in a snap. It was overwhelming. I had been working for about 10 years for this company. I had worked hard. I had done everything I felt that had been asked. But when I look back on it now, I hadn't done as much as I could have. And that was the lesson I learned from it. But I went home to my wife, my two small children, and my one very large mortgage, feeling every bit the victim. Ultimately, I went through an outplacement process with an extraordinary outplacement person who started me focusing forward. not living in the rearview mirror of what could have been and what could I have done differently, but I needed to get a job and I needed to get back on my career track. So that's what started me out on this journey of trying to find my way. You know, there's a wonderful quote from Brené Brown, and I'm going to be doing a podcast with her in a couple of weeks. And every year I pick a favorite quote. And this past year, my favorite quote was from Brené. And this quote is, you can either walk inside your story and own it, or you can stand outside your story and hustle for your worthiness every day. And basically, through my career, up to that point in time, I was an oldest child. I was walking in my parents' story for me, my teacher's story for me, my coach's stories for me, and then my boss's stories for me. But I wasn't walking inside my story. And I began to learn that I certainly had to pay attention to the world around me, but I had to be much more well anchored in terms of my convictions and the things I believed in. And that's what started me on this journey 40 years ago now, almost 38 years ago. And I'm just about midway. I'm starting to get it. You know, I'll turn 70 in a couple of weeks, and I'm getting close. So that's the background there. And that's why I think this book right now is so essential for people in such an unsettling time.
So you've reached youthful middle age. I'm glad to hear that. So what actually called you to write this book? I mean, you've lived your leadership career, but why this book?
Well, this book, I think it was essential when we wrote it. And we launched it on March 5th of last year, right into the teeth of the pandemic. We started canceling the launch events on March 6th, and we're living the relaunch right now. But we wrote it because one of my mentors, a guy by the name of Warren Bennis, coined the phrase in 1987 that we were living in a VUCA world, V-U-C-A, VUCA. And it's volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. People should Google it. It's really fascinating. And in 1987, he was saying it was a VUCA world. Today, it's a VUCA world on steroids. It's volatile, it's uncertain, it's complex, increasingly so and ambiguous. And people are getting overwhelmed by it. And they're being buffeted by all the storms and the winds coming at them. And what we're observing is they don't have their rudder in the water in terms of what they believe. You know, Maya Angelou has a great quote. She talks about courage, and she says, you know, courage is the most important trait, because without courage, you can't practice any other trait with consistency. You can't have the courage of your convictions. And what I was discovering in my work life was people hadn't done enough work to know what their convictions were. So it was hard to have courage. And we're trying to help people reflect on their convictions, learn from the world around them, build an approach that works for them and gives them a little more confidence when they go through the trials and tribulations of everyday life, which is, it's overwhelming, right? It's a cockamamie life. Nobody has time to do anything. And so our goal was to help them build a strong foundation. Amy will talk about this. Build a strong foundation so that they could deal with the winds of change that were coming in their lives. So that's why we wrote it. I teach this work now, and the people that go through our programming are becoming so much better anchored in what they believe in and how they want to impact the world in a way that honors the expectations the world has of them. So it's been a very fulfilling chapter here for me.
So Doug and Amy, who are you writing for? Are you writing for, you know, beginning in their career, mid-career, out of work, frustrated, late career, all of the above? Who would get the most out of this book?
I'll start, but then Amy would be a strong finish. We're writing for all aspiring leaders. You know, and I know you've been through the book, John. This book would have worked for me as a father. It would have worked if I was a teacher or a superintendent of a school, or if I worked in a civic organization or a nonprofit organization, would have worked. My experience largely captured in this book, although it's not exclusive, is in the corporate world. But aspiring leaders in all walks of life who hunger to do better and are finding it, they're just stuck. They're just stuck. They're overwhelmed and they're stuck. And we, our goal is to help them get unstuck. And but all aspiring leaders, and Amy, bring it home.
Well, thanks, Doug. And you asked Doug about his story of getting fired, and the book opens with this devastating story. And the reason we anchored a book written by somebody as accomplished and experienced chairman CEO like Doug in this moment of vulnerability is because we wanted the process to be so approachable for anyone. You don't have to have already climbed the ladder. You don't have to be a CEO to get something out of this process. You just have to start. We have a Arthur Ashe quote that we use a lot, which I think is, start where you are, use what you have, do what you can. And that's very much the spirit of the blueprint process. So somebody who is a chairman CEO like Doug can get something out of it, but somebody who's just lost in the muck of this, as Doug would say, cockamamie life, can also just start where they are and do what they can. And this gives them a process to get started.
Amy, while you're talking about that, speaking of process, how do two people write a book? Because you're not always in the same location. You obviously go at things a little bit differently. You're a very experienced writer. Doug has a lot of great ideas. How do you put it all together?
Well, in our case, I had the benefit of, I think the most important thing for a collaboration is trust. And I'd had the benefit of already working for Doug as a content creator, writer, and communicator for years prior to him engaging me to write this book with him. So we'd already been disseminating this leadership message to a broad audience. We'd already been collaborating that way for years, which created a strong foundation, if you will, to allow us to write this book together. And you also just have to be in constant communication. You know, we wrote this book in a very 2020 way in 2019. We were just on phone calls, sending each other pages back and forth, which is kind of the way everyone's learned to collaborate now. Everyone's on Zoom. People are working from their homes. Doug, we were trailblazers. We were writing the book this way, not sharing physical space for a lot of 2019. And I think one of the most important things for a collaboration like this, if you're a novelist and it's just your vision, you can just sit down in the chair and write. For us, we had to have a lot of discipline and organization. We have a quote from Stephen Covey that was one of Doug's greatest influences and mentors. And he says, begin with the end in mind. So one of the most important processes for writing this book together was, before we even wrote the book, was we had a book proposal. And that's your way of thinking through an outline and being really organized. So before you even say it, you know what you're going to say before you say it. And of course, along the journey, along the writing process, you're going to uncover insights and stories that you hadn't thought of in the book proposal. But to have this document that keeps you organized, and then you have deadlines that you adhere to, for us, with near militants, I would say, wouldn't you, Doug?
Yeah.
Because we're writing and we're editing at the same time. I'm sending Doug pages, he's editing them, and while he's editing them, I'm writing the next crop. And then you build in a buffer so that when I get those edits back, I'm working on those, but we haven't lost any ground on the timeline. We're still moving forward. So it was a very organized process, and I think that helped a lot. What do you think, Doug?
I do, and I think I agree with you. Probably the most important piece of this was that Amy and I had worked together. And so before we started, she can finish my sentences in the leadership space. And I might say something, and then she would say to me, well, don't you really mean this? And she was right. And so having worked together, doing social media work and articles and social media in particular, where you're iterating every day and sharpening your messaging in nice tight pieces, we became pretty fluent at talking the concepts here. So that was probably the single biggest thing that worked for us. The other piece that I love, and we talk about this in the book up front, is, look, I'm a 70-year-old guy, or will be in a couple of weeks. My work experience, John, and I bet it's similar to yours and people of our vintage, if you will, I had 28 bosses. Oh. 27 of them were men. 26 of them were white men. And they had bosses. and all of those bosses were white men. And so in my work experience of people I worked for, my leadership, the people that led me, I, you know, 55 out of 56 people were men, you know. And here I'm trying to bring the written word and the spirit of what I've learned to an audience that's just much more diverse and much richer and has a different view of the world. And I pride myself on staying current and trying to be in touch. But if I had written this book by myself, it wouldn't be nearly as good as it is with Amy's influence, because she's viewing it through the eyes of a gifted writer who's 30 something, you know? So you take the 30 something writer and the old white male, you put it together, and this is a place where I think you can really celebrate diversity of thought and diversity of expression. And that's what I loved about it. It's just so much better than I could have ever done without Amy. Did you have you?
Interesting thought. Amy, on that score, a lot of people tune into these to sort of learn about the writing process. So maybe just to finish this subject, what best practices do you have that people could bring to their writing craft?
Yes. And thank you, Doug, for those kind words. I appreciate it very much. And before I answer your question, I just want to mention that it is really important in a collaboration to have somebody like Doug who values the role of the writer, not just as putting words on paper, but as a critical thinking partner. You're both pushing the thinking together. And that's really important if you want a collaboration for a book like this to write, because something that stuck out to me as we were writing the book is Doug says, we define it this way in the book, leadership is the art and science of influencing people in a specific direction. This doesn't have to occur in a hierarchical space. It can be up, down, or sideways. But thinking about what the goal of writing together is, this quest for clarity, and you're really looking as a writer to persuade and to delight and to explain, and these are all tools of influence. And as I was thinking what I'm bringing to the process writing this book about leadership, it really became kind of this aha moment for me that writing is leadership. And I think the audience here might appreciate this today, because we have leaders and writers on the call with us, that you are, as a writer, you are leading the reader. And that's really important, and it's important to engage with that responsibility thoughtfully. That said, some tools for writers. One of the most important, I think, that every writer needs to hear, myself included, and this is actually a rallying cry in the book, The Blueprint. We tell people to forget perfection. Now, writers are all afflicted with this malady of writer's block, and it comes from this crushing anxiety of not getting it just right. And There's a quote from Nora Roberts. She says, you know, I can fix a bad page, I can't fix a blank page. And this is something that I have to hear over and over again. You have to find a way to just do it. And there is this crush of writing advice, and a lot of it gets really similar. It's you have to sit in the chair every day. No matter what, even if your house is on fire and your dog's biting you, you have to sit in that writer's chair every day. And I think that loses some of the nuance, because, you know, we can't all be Stephen King. We can't all have this superhuman innate desire and discipline to spend every waking moment writing. So I think if we want to forget perfection and we want to just get it done, we have to do a little reflection to figure out what motivates us. And this is actually parallel to the blueprint process. But for me, I realized, for better or worse, I don't mind letting myself down, which isn't great, but it's just the truth. But I can't stand to let somebody else down. So for me as a writer, it's creating tension in my life and engineering accountability from external stakeholders so that I get what needs to be done. In the case with Doug, we had deadlines. We had a publisher who was looking for us to meet deadlines. My boss, Doug. So that is a natural fit for me to create that time pressure, those deadlines. But if you're somebody who doesn't have to answer to anyone and you just want to get writing done, you can engineer accountability in other ways. I say to declare yourself, which is another Doug-ism. Doug declares himself as a leader. I say declare yourself, tell everyone you're working on a project. Tell everyone you know in your life, I'm a writer and I'm working on X. And ultimately, these people are going to come back and ask you, how's this project going? What's going on with that project you told everyone about? So you can find ways to engineer kind of people to not nag you, but to have that accountability if you're motivated externally, like me. So find what works for you and forget perfection and find a way to get it done.
Good advice. You laugh. I'm writing the family story of our family. And Doug, my seventh great grandmother was killed in the Salem witch trial. So you're going to have that city in common. I wanted to shift to you in the book, talk about other books on leadership. And you quote some really terrific thinkers in the field of leadership. And Lord knows there's been a lot of books about leadership written. What makes the blueprint different? What's your unique angle, or what help do you bring people that they wouldn't find in all the other leadership books they can find in the library?
It's a good question. It is unique, and I'll tell you why. The only book that I'm familiar with that is sort of cut from the same cloth is Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, where he shares principles for how to be effective with you, but then he has you take your own journey through it and actually write your own personal mission statement and figure out how you want to walk in the world and learning these principles. The blueprint is not about me. It's all about you. And it's about helping you uncover a foundation that speaks uniquely well to you. And most of the leadership books are books written by either people who've never done it but studied it, and they add value because they have a detached third-party perspective, which I think is important to have. But I would argue it's insufficient, because anybody who's working in there and carrying the load every day, 365 days a year, and has to show up and deal with the same people the next week and the next week and the next week will tell you, those books are maybe useful, but they won't help me get my job done. And then there are some other books that are written by iconic leaders who said, here are the five things I did, and you ought to do these five things. But they're about that leader. They're not about you. So the blueprint is designed to help you build your own foundation, reflect on your life, study the world around you in a way that works for you, and build your own leadership philosophy. And that can be done. And the other important thing about this book is it's done with a recognition that you have a cockamamie life and you have no time to do any of this. So we built it in a bite-sized way, studying the evolution of habits. James Clear, who wrote Atomic Habits, is the latest habit person. And we've studied how to find habits that can work for you in a busy life. And we've engineered that approach into this book so that you can start to build your own leadership model, your own leadership philosophy in bite-sized bites. Forget perfection. But as you know, John, the key to success is continuous improvement. And it's about doing a little better tomorrow than you did today. And if you do a little better tomorrow every day, you ultimately find out the better is best. And it's about continuous improvement. So we built something that can be approached in. Amy and I do a two-day boot camp, and we can get people started on this. And they build their own leadership model. And then the last thing I'd say is they build this model. We help them bring it to life with habits and practices that they can do on Monday morning. And then we help them think through, okay, this has been great. I've been in la-la land for 2 days with you, Doug. Now I've got to go back to the real world. And we help them build their reentry plan. Okay, how are you going to take this back into the world of work and sustain the effort in a practical way so that you can look back on this 30 days later and say, you know, it really made a difference. So it's a blend of the craft of teaching leadership, but also with a very pragmatic lens. And that's what I think is unusual, as well as it's all focused on the individual.
So I found the structure interesting. For those who've not read it, it goes through six steps of the building your foundation, sort of the blueprint part. And it's there's a lot of introspection, a lot of work required to get that done, a lot of thought required to get that done. And then you have sort of your management or your leadership manifesto.
Yeah.
And it struck me a little bit like those are the answers to the quiz they were just taking. And I'm curious about how it got structured that way, so that you make them do all the introspection, all the thinking, and then you give the reader a lot of really, really useful, practical advice on ways to approach leadership. How did you end up structuring it that way?
Well, very intentionally, and Amy can comment on this, but you know, the most important thing, those 10 in the Leadership Manifesto in the back half of the book, those are my 10 things that were important to me. But the whole premise of this book is it's not about what's important to me. It's about you sorting through what's important for you. And so what we encourage people to do is the first time through building their own leadership model and crafting their own leadership approach, they shouldn't be reading about my 10 things. They should be reflecting on what are the things that really speak to them in a deep, deep way. You know, one of my mentors, Warren Bennis, had this great quote. You know, he said, becoming a leader is synonymous with becoming yourself. It's precisely that simple, and it is also that difficult. So as people explore themselves and try and land on the courage of their convictions, that's what's most important about the blueprint. And then I share with them mine. And then we encourage them to reflect on what they've read about in mine and maybe integrate them as they iterate back through their model. But it's all about them. It's not about me. Amy's the one who guided me in that direction, actually. Amy?
Well, Doug, you explained it perfectly, but it really is, we worry about being too prescriptive. Even though Doug... We want to have a clear point of view because Doug's leadership expertise and his story and his experience is special and unique, and he has a lot of wisdom to share. But if we started with this manifesto, and don't get scared by the word manifesto, it's not a deranged, you know, screed. It is very thoughtful. But if people read that first, then their leadership foundation would look too much like Doug's. And we find this even in our blueprint bootcamp, which is a training program anchored in the insights of the blueprint. We have people do pre-work before they come to the program, because if they get overexposed to Doug's leadership model, the Conant Leadership Flywheel, we're going to have a bunch of people who just are making flywheels. So we don't want to exert so much prescriptive influence over somebody's unique leadership model before they have a chance to go through the process. So that's kind of why it's structured that way.
Well, I found it incredibly useful to walk through the six steps, but it is difficult in that there's no teacher, there's no one sort of, I mean, you can talk to other people, but you're asked to think your own thoughts and your own foundation, your own principles, what you believe in, all of which you should have a foundation like that. But since it is self-help, and since there are a lot of other things going on in one's life, what advice do you have for someone who's stuck on level 3, which I think is called study? And they look up and they see there's, you know, six more steps, or there's three more steps, and the top one is called improve. And they've been doing that all along. How do you get them sort of, pardon the expression, unstuck and make sure they finish their way through the whole blueprint?
Amy, the key idea here is forget perfection. Whatever you do when you go through this process the first time is wrong. It's not going to be fully formed. And so your first step is envision the future you want. And what are your goals to be as a leader? And whatever you pick will be wrong. That's okay. Then you reflect on your life and feather that into your thinking. Then you study the world around you, people that you respect and you can learn from. Doesn't have to be everybody. It will be incomplete. And then you build your own model based on that thinking. You identify some practices for it. And then you start to work on a continuous improvement loop. So after you go through it once, you say, oh, how did that go? And you go back and say, would I change my goals a little bit here? Am I missing something in reflection now that I'm sort of into this? Is there somebody else I want to study or learn from? How would I tweak my plan? And so the key to all of this is forget perfection, give it the time you have to give it, and just stay with it. And what we find is after people have iterated through it a time or two, it's second nature. You know, how can I, you know, are my goals right? Is there anything I I could have learned from my past that I haven't really dealt with yet? Is there anybody I could learn from? How would I change my leadership thinking a little bit? What would I tweak here? And play with it and enjoy it and say, because ultimately this is a reflection of you and how you want to walk in the world, and just enjoy the ride. What people tell us, I just received an email today from Melissa. She's head of training and development for NetJets. And she was saying how helpful it is. She just went through the process, and it's, she feels more effective and more fulfilled every day because she's being more like the leader she wants to be, knowing that it's not perfect, but she'll do a little better tomorrow than she did today. And that kind of forget perfection, just do the best you can approach is really the only way to go through this in a cockamamie life. You can't go get a Harvard MBA and put your life on hold and spend a few hundred thousand dollars. You have to feather this into your life as it is now. In fact, in the book, we talk about how important it is that this process has to nest perfectly in your life as it is. If it doesn't nest perfectly, you won't sustain it. So we have you building it in a way that fits. And if not, we all know about the habits we have when we go on a diet on January 1st after the holidays and we say, okay, now I'm going to lose 10 pounds and I'm going to give up this and I'm going to give up that. And then all of a sudden, you can't sustain it because it doesn't fit into your cockamamie life. And we don't want to have that. We want to build something that's practical that you can use time and again. That's what Stephen Covey did with the Seven Habits in many ways. And that's what we tried to do here.
Amy, you want to add anything? Or
I covered it all, but it's the process of iteration is so important that step six is improve. It's one of the steps in the process is to just keep iterating in a way that works for you. And so each step is bite-sized. You don't have to approach the process saying, I'm going to get through all of this all at once. If you can just start with step one and envision, you're one step closer to becoming the leader, the fullest expression of the leader that you want to be and were meant to be. So it's bite-sized by design.
Yeah. Wait, we talk about forget perfection, embrace iteration. That's the idea. Forget perfection, embrace iteration.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I had heard an expression that was along the lines of progressive improvement beats postponed perfection, which is a similar thing. Now, you explain in the book that about a leadership purpose, sort of a unifying why, can help empower leaders to sort of not just live for their resume, but live for their eulogy. And so explain a little bit for the folks why a purpose is so important and how the blueprint can help a person kind of find their own purpose.
Yeah, this was all triggered by a wonderful book, a wonderful TED Talk that David Brooks gave, the New York Times columnist, why, you know, are you living for your resume or your eulogy? And in that TED Talk, he talks about the learnings he had from Joseph, Jewish rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. And this is all based on his work. And want to give him credit, but David Brooks brought it to life for me. And he comments that, you know, we get sucked into living for our resume. Did I get a parking spot closer to the elevator? Did I get my bonus? Am I keeping up with this person and that person? And when am I going to get promoted relative to someone else? And we get trapped in that kind of game. And then he observes that at the end of our life, when we talk about what do you want your eulogy to look like, it bears no resemblance to the life you've chosen to lead. And so that was his observation. And our perspective is you have to embrace both. It's not one or the other. Am I living for my resume or my eulogy? I'm going to live for my eulogy, but I'm going to be building a resume that's connected to it. And a purpose does that. A purpose says, In my case, I want to help build high performance or high trust, high performance teams that honor people, defy the critics, and thrive in the face of adversity. That's what I love to do. That's what I want to do. It has an element of performance and resume building embedded in it. It also has what I want to be known for as someone who honors people and who tries to bring the eye of the tiger to everything he encounters. And that one phrase has tied all that together for me. And as I've gone through my career, I've found that if I stay focused on my leadership purpose, which is what you do in step one of our book, it helps me keep my eulogy in mind and build my life in a way that's connected to it. And Amy, you should comment on this. I thought you contributed mightily to the articulation of this in the book.
Thanks, Doug. You've explained it very well. But something that's important to understand is once you understand that, I think a lot of leaders can get to the point where they understand that this purpose is so important. And the way we frame it in the book, it is this unifying why that connects your eulogy virtues and your resume virtues and helps you align those. So, but a lot of leaders then feel overwhelmed. Okay, I need a purpose. How do I figure that out? You can't just kind of wait to be struck by some epiphany from above. So what we designed in the blueprint is a proactive way to uncover what that purpose is. There are literally prompts for reflection. We ask you the questions that you might not think to ask yourself because it's hard. It's a heavy lift. How do I discover my purpose? And that's why we really wanted to be that helping hand, go through these questions for reflection, and you'll at least come out of the blueprint with a rough draft of your purpose. Even if you change it, even if you have to scrap it five times, it really gives you a process to be proactive about uncovering your purpose rather than waiting for, you know, heavenly epiphany to strike you, which I think is helpful for a lot of leaders.
You started this book in 2018, and in that sense, you are ahead of your time on this front. And that is, you use an expression in the book called something along the lines of make meaning, not money. And now companies are starting to realize that maybe they should be about making meaning, not money. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what that means to the individual leader, the business of making meaning, not money.
Well, I'm also chair of the Center for High Ambition Leadership in Boston. And there we talk about our belief. It comes from a book written by Harvard Professor Emeritus Mike Beer, and it was called Higher Ambition, How Great Leaders Create Economic and Social Value. Terrific book. And we started this nonprofit built around that concept. And now we talk about purposeful leaders building higher performing organizations and a better world. And I've got to tell you, I see this going on everywhere, and I have been seeing it for the last decade. I see companies leaning into the concept of total, what I would call going from total share owner returns, if we talk business, to total stakeholder returns. And they're looking at their role in society as well as their role within their sphere of influence with stakeholders. And I think leaders have to do that as well. I honestly believe that great leaders can create and will create economic and social value. They just have to frame it that way to begin with and realize that whether you're running electrical engineering services or a food company, you are serving people and you are focusing on meeting the needs of all of your stakeholders in a compelling way. It's not just about shareholders. And so I see leaders today looking for that purpose connected to their resume building and hungering to make a difference. Look, when I was CEO of Campbell, we published two things on our portal for all of our employees. We published our annual report and our corporate social responsibility report. Which one do you think was opened? Not the annual report.
Latter.
None of the employees could have cared less. But the corporate social responsibility report was opened by everyone. We subsequently learned it was shared with everyone. Parents would share it with their children. Look at what mom or dad's company is doing to help fifth generation family farms or to preserve water or lower our footprint. And And that was what was meaningful to our employees. We found there was this beautiful relationship that began with, we focused on taking care of our workplace. We did better in the marketplace. And then we tried to help build a better world. And the more we leaned into that idea, people got more engaged in the workplace and we did better in the marketplace. I mean, this can be a cycle of success that has great endurance. So I'm happy to say, I believe will be a cost of doing business going forward. And every enterprise that has any desire to be enduring is going to have a sense of purpose that transcends the ordinary. You have no choice.
Yes, and it's a sense of purpose that everybody can, the whole team can buy into.
That all stakeholders can buy into. Right. Your customers, your suppliers, and society.
Now, one question I did want to ask is, your book is filled with a lot of great advice. And in truth, it comes close in some ways to being common sense. But it's always amazed me how common sense is not in common usage. But it's a little like your comment about the habits, you know, the going on a diet. Someone has realized they need to get unstuck and they start going through the process and maybe they make it to step six and can iterate a bit. But in the crush of business, in the hurly burly world we all live in, especially the one we live in now, it's easy to get off track and to forget the common sense things you should be doing, the common sense things the book taught you. What does the book do to help people, unlike the dieter, kind of stick to the plan and to keep the rudder in the water and to keep moving forward in with their purpose?
Well, the first piece is we make it very approachable. And we say, forget perfection, do the best you can with what you have, where you are, and let's just iterate together. And we find that creates freedom for the person to engage in a way that works for them. And we acknowledge that this has to nest perfectly in your cockamamie life. So let's build it that way from the outset. The other thing we do is we have a very active ongoing dialogue with everyone that participates in Conant Leadership. I mean, you can connect to us through our website or every day on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, or Instagram. So there is a constant dialogue going on here. I guess a third thing is we encourage you, as you get up and running with this, to share it, going back to something Amy talked about, to create a sense of accountability with someone else. And we encourage you that first week you go back, the second thing we suggest is that you share this emerging thinking with a trusted colleague, one trusted colleague. And I'm telling you, that's a big step, because you talk to somebody you trust who knows your company, knows your situation, knows your organization if it's a nonprofit, and you share, you know, I just went through this, I'm trying to figure this out. What do you think? Does this reflect the person, me? Does this seem to make sense? And once you start sharing it with someone else, you declare yourself, which we also talk about in the book, it makes it much easier to go through this. You're not alone. You don't need to be alone in this space. You just need to find people you trust to share it with, and it gets much easier. What would you say, Amy?
Agree. And building on that, it is hard to keep your rudder in the water with a change process. So understanding that, the idea behind building the foundation is helping you to articulate, setting aside the time is part of it, to help you articulate what matters to you as a leader, how you want to show up, what you expect from others, what you expect from yourself. Leaders are so busy reacting to everything that comes at them in a day, even just setting aside the time to think through these things can be a radical act and an enormous step forward. Because once you've gone through it once, you have that language forever. Even if you don't keep working the territory, you at least know now, I'm a leader who values courage over everything. I'm an independent thinker. I'm whatever words you found in the process, you have that language with you forever, whether or not you continue to work the territory or not. And that alone has immense power for leaders.
You know, as leaders, we have plans for everything. Any leader I talk to has a plan. Here's my strategic plan. Here's my monthly plan. here's my operations plan, here's my procurement plan. We have plans for everything. I ask a leader, well, what's your plan for your leadership? And it's, well, quite frankly, I'm doing it by the seat of my pants. And I'm telling you, leaders, we're affecting people's lives. I treat this responsibility as sacred ground. And we got to do better than by the seat of our pants because we're busy. That's just not good enough. You owe people more than that. And so you have to set aside the time. We set aside the time for everything else. This is the most important thing. You know, as a CEO, and you learn this, I learned this the hard way, I found out I really don't do anything. Everybody that works for us does all the work. I have to lead them in an impactful way. It's a big job. I ought to think about it. I shouldn't do it by the seat of my pants. I don't care if you're working with two or 200 or 200,000. So you have to become intentional. You have to find some time. But we know it's not easy, so we give you ways to do it. But look, if you want to be a leader, you got to step up, and you've got to engage, and you got to own it, and you got to be accountable for it. You're affecting people's lives.
One thing I did find interesting and useful was you give sort of a baby steps approach to how to take it to the workplace and build on it. And I think that was very helpful. And I think that's something that people can start with and prove to themselves, this diet works. I can live on this. And with that, let me thank Doug and Amy so much for taking the time, so much for writing the book. My only reaction to the book that I told Doug before, the thought that I had as I was reading through it kept recurring is, where was this when I was starting out? It's a great book to get started with, and it's a great book to pick up if you're in mid-career or late career, as long as you're into continuous improvement. So thanks for the book. Thanks for this session. Great conversation. Very much appreciated. Absolutely like to thank everybody who has tuned in. We appreciate your participation in this session. We hope you got a lot out of it. We hope you enjoy the Writers Museum programs. And certainly, if you'd like to be sure you don't miss any of these great programs, please become a member. And we'll be sure you get posted on all the programs that happen in the future. Thanks again to everybody. And everybody, be safe. And thanks a lot for being part of this session. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, opera librettist Jean Shearer discusses the process of transforming Herman Melville's Moby Dick into a critically acclaimed opera. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.